Sitting in the Oval Office, surrounded by retired military personnel, President Obama has signed an executive order to shut down the controversial detention camp.
The message that we are sending around the world is that the United States intends to prosecute the ongoing struggle against violence and terrorism in a manner that is consistent with our values and our ideals.
Almost 800 people have passed through the Guantanamo Bay detention camp. During the two Bush presidencies, the prison became notorious for inhumane interrogation and denial of basic legal rights. One of the first things Barack Obama did on becoming U.S. president was sign an executive order to close Guantanamo. 2 years later, it's still open, and prospects for its closure seem even more remote than they did in 2009. I'm Keri Phillips, and today on Rear Vision we'll look back over almost a decade of legal and political battles to see why it is that President Obama has been unable to fulfil this key election promise. During the last part of the 20th century, the US naval base at Guantanamo Bay, established as a fueling station under a treaty signed with Cuba in 1903, was used, among other things, as a place to hold Cuban and Haitian refugees. After the 9/11 terrorist attacks in New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania, President Bush made it the central prison for suspects in the War on Terror. Jonathan Hafetz is a professor at Seton Hall Law School in New Jersey. His most recent book is Habeas Corpus After 9/11.
The decision to choose Guantanamo after 9/11 was motivated principally by a desire to hold individuals who the United States either suspected of terrorist activity or military activity and who the United States wished to obtain information from. And it chose to bring them to Guantanamo as opposed to other places because it was, on the one hand, a very secure area for the United States, a military base where the United States had total control, and it was not part of the United States in a formal sense. That is, the sovereignty over Guantanamo still remains in Cuba, even though, as a factual matter, it's totally in the power and control of the United States. And this was done for a very strategic and, I think, ultimately dark and unfortunate reason, which was it was a way to try to keep the prisoners without access to the U.S. courts in a place that, at least the administration at the time, the Bush administration argued, was beyond the law. A prison that would not be subject to any kind of scrutiny by the courts or the public or press.
The detainees held at Guantanamo Bay are, according to the Pentagon, some of the most dangerous men on Earth. So dangerous, the US military said they would use their teeth to gnaw through the hydraulics to bring down the transport planes which deposited them in Cuba. That's why they were chained, hooded, and not allowed to move once they got on board for the 20-hour flight from Afghanistan.
The prisoners who were brought to Guantanamo, starting in January of 2002, were from all parts of the world. I mean, there were prisoners from more than 40 different countries who were brought to Guantanamo, some from the Middle East, others from Europe. As you know, prisoners from Australia, David Hicks, there were prisoners brought from all different parts of the world to Guantanamo. Some of them were picked up and seized in or around Afghanistan following the military conflict there in October 2001. Others were brought from places far from any kind of battlefield. There were people flown from Bosnia, people taken from Gambia in Africa, from the Middle East. So there are people that were picked up from all over the world as part of what the Bush administration called a global battlefield, where you could just simply pick people up in this global war on terror and bring them across the world to Guantanamo and hold them in this prison.
The legal status of the Guantanamo Bay detainees put them outside both America's civilian and military justice systems.
They will not be treated as prisoners of war.
The detainees will remain just that, and according to the president's spokesman, Ari Fleischer, they certainly won't be accorded some of the comforts a prisoner of war could expect.
One of the things, for example, if they were POWs that they'd be entitled to, which they are not going to get, is going to be a stipend or tobacco. The Geneva Convention was written in a very different era following the war on terrorism, where people don't wear uniforms and they come from 30 different nations, not any one recognized nation with whom the United States is fighting a war.
The prisoners were deemed to be enemy combatants. This was a term that was new and didn't have any real basis in international law. They were combatants, but combatants traditionally had legal status under the Geneva Conventions and were treated as prisoners of war, and as such were entitled to basic protections, including protections from a range of mistreatment. The administration, however, deemed the prisoners to be enemy combatants as a way to create a new legal category, so they had no legal protections. They were treated as wartime captives, so they could be held without criminal prosecution. At the same time, they were not prisoners of war, so they did not have any of the rights under the Geneva Conventions. So again, it was a creation of this new legal category in order to authorize indefinite arbitrary detention and also to allow for the use of the enhanced interrogation tactics or aggressive interrogation tactics that in some instances constituted torture, and even when they didn't, were violations of human rights and constituted cruel and unusual treatment.
The detainees were denied access to a lawyer, the right to a trial, or even knowledge of the charges against them. During the Bush years, there were three significant Supreme Court decisions in relation to Guantanamo detainees' legal rights. The first, in 2004, established that the US court system did have the authority under federal law to decide whether those held in Guantanamo Bay had been wrongfully imprisoned.
The issue there was whether the detainees had a right to habeas corpus, that is, a right to challenge their detention in court and to demand that the government provide the court with a lawful basis for their detention. In that case, the Supreme Court ruled by a 6-3 vote that the detainees had a right to habeas corpus under a federal statute, effectively the federal habeas corpus statute. But it didn't say anything else. It didn't comment on the legal category of enemy combatants. It didn't describe what kind of hearing the detainees were entitled to or what kinds of protections it was entitled to. It simply said they could access the courts. Up until that point, no detainee had seen a lawyer. No lawyers had been allowed to go down to Guantanamo. So that was a transformative decision in a number of respects. I think most importantly, it provided the basis for lawyers to start going down to Guantanamo to visit clients. It enabled lawyers to see what was happening, to hear client stories. And although the lawyers operated under severe restrictions, including restrictions that prevented them from discussing what the clients had told them without getting it cleared through a government screening committee, some of the truth started to come out, and I think it started to alter some of the perceptions and put some holes in some of the rhetoric that the Bush administration had been propounding, like, for example, that all of the detainees were the worst of the worst, and that they were all these savage criminals. And I think it challenged the story or the narrative that the Bush administration had placed before the public in terms of describing all the detainees at Guantanamo.
The U.S. Congress responded by passing the Detainee Treatment Act in 2005, which stripped the courts of the power to hear the Guantanamo cases by amending the federal habeas corpus statute. Back in November 2001, President Bush had issued a military order called Detention, Treatment and Trial of Certain Non-Citizens in the War Against Terrorism. Among other things, the order specified that some detainees could be tried in military commissions, where their rights would be more limited than in either the civilian or military justice systems. The legality of these military tribunals sparked another landmark ruling by the Supreme Court.
There was another decision in 2006, a case called Hamdan versus Rumsfeld, which involved a challenge to military commissions. But in the course of reaching that decision, the Supreme Court said that the Detainee Treatment Act did not apply to pending cases. That is, it didn't apply to cases that had already been filed with the courts. So the habeas corpus challenges could continue. So after the Hamdan decision, the Congress passed another statute, a second statute called the Military Commissions Act of 2006, which deprived the courts of habeas corpus jurisdiction. And this time Congress made very clear this was intended to cover all cases, past, present, future, so that the courts would not have authority under federal law to hear the Guantanamo petitions. So that prompted the third of the three Guantanamo Supreme Court decisions, Boumediene versus Bush, where the constitutionality of that statute was challenged. And what the court ruled in June of 2008 was that this statute violated a provision of the Constitution called the Habeas Corpus Suspension Clause, which limits Congress' ability to take away the habeas right. And so the court said that the suspension clause had been violated and that the government had not put in any kind of fair procedures. And as a consequence, the detainees were entitled to judicial hearings to challenge their detention. And so what we've seen since Boumediene, which was decided about 2.5 years ago now, is all of these individual habeas corpus challenges by the detainees working their way through the courts. And in about, you know, the figures change a lot, but in about 65% of the cases, the detainees have prevailed at the district court, that the government has not been able to justify the detention.
According to Benjamin Witters, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, this means there have been three ways for a Guantanamo detainee to have his case heard.
The most common way has been through the habeas process. These are not criminal cases. These are detainees saying, hey, it's not lawful to detain me under the laws of war. And these cases, there have been several dozen of them, have now gone to completion. Those aren't criminal cases. They're traditional habeas cases or untraditional habeas cases. Then the second possibility is you might have a military commission trial, and military commissions are at Guantanamo, and they're criminal proceedings in the military justice system used to try allegations of war crimes. And there have been a handful of those, most of which have been resolved by plea agreements, including David Hicks. And then the third possibility is trial in U.S. federal court, and that there has only been one of.
That was the trial of Ahmed Gailani, who was sentenced in a federal court in New York in January to life without parole for his involvement in the 1998 bombings of two American embassies in East Africa, where thousands were wounded and 224 died. This was the first time that a former detainee from Guantanamo Bay had been tried in a civilian court on U.S. soil. The vast bulk of the Guantanamo detainees have been transferred to some 50 different countries, most of them without ever being tried in a U.S. court.
And, you know, one of the things that people don't understand about the Bush administration is how hard they worked on this issue. People think the Bush administration just threw the law out the window at Guantanamo, and the reality is a lot more complicated than that. Of the 800 people who passed through Guantanamo, more than 500 of them were released or transferred by the Bush administration. Some of them were transferred because the government determined that they had been detained in error. That's actually a relatively small number. The much larger number were transferred as their home governments became capable of taking responsibility for them. So particularly as the Saudi government began to be willing to take its people back and figured out what it wanted to do with them and how to handle them, we transferred very large numbers of Saudis back to Saudi Arabia. And similarly, as the allied forces in Afghanistan built up the Afghan government to the point that it was capable of taking responsibility for a lot of Afghan detainees, U.S. forces have transferred a bunch of Afghans, a very large number, back to Afghanistan. And the Bush administration, a lot of the heavy lifting, not of closing Guantanamo, because that's what they're still working on that, but of reducing the size of Guantanamo and making it a more manageable problem, a lot of that work was done in the late Bush administration. So one of the problems that the Obama administration had when they came in was that a lot of the people who would have been easy to release and would have been able to reduce the population quickly by releasing, they were already gone. And the people who were left were the really hard cases, cases where it was very hard to find countries that were willing to take them, cases of people, you know, you might not be able to bring to trial, but you really thought were really dangerous, and cases of people who you would really like to make a criminal case against, but there were real problems with the evidence.
This is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National with Keri Phillips. Today we're looking at why it is that President Obama has failed to fulfill a key election promise to close Guantanamo Bay detention camp. And if you'd like to know more about what's happened to the almost 800 detainees who've been through Guantanamo, do explore this week's special feature online at the ABC website. There's a link on the Rear Vision webpage for this program, abc.net.au/rn/rearvision, or just Google Rear Vision. By the time the second Bush administration came to an end, Guantanamo had become notorious for its harsh interrogation methods, and the military commissions had become widely condemned as a means to sidestep the American legal system. During the presidential campaign of 2008, Barack Obama declared his commitment to close the detention camp. In January 2009, he became president and made it one of his first tasks.
Well, after announcing on his second day in office that he was going to close the Guantanamo prison, President Obama set up a task force to review all of the detainee cases. The problem was it was a very bold, symbolic move, you know, the idea that we're going to close Guantanamo, but Obama at that point didn't actually have a blueprint or plan in place as to what was going to happen with the detainees. And the task force had really two functions. One was to review the existing cases, to review the files of the cases, and the second thing was to try to formulate a appropriate policy with respect to counterterrorism detentions. And so the administration spent the first year reviewing cases and determining kind of what the approach should be. At the same time, in laying out what some of the policies would be, there was an indication that Obama was going to continue a number of the Bush administration policies. So Obama announced that even though he was committed to closing Guantanamo, the United States was going to revive military commissions, the discredited tribunals used to try detainees of war crimes that had been struck down by the Supreme Court and had been condemned internationally for failing to meet basic standards of due process and human rights. And in addition, that there was a preference for trying detainees in federal court, in the regular courts, where they receive full due process. That was only a preference. And that some detainees would be tried in military commissions, and some other detainees might be detained indefinitely without charge.
Well, so Obama came in clearly intending to close Guantanamo, stating that very publicly, and he set up a process in those executive orders by which to do it. And what the process said, if you go back and you look at the executive orders, is study the entire population, look at every single case, and see which cases you can resolve by trial. See which cases you can resolve by transferring somebody to another country. And then see if there's anybody left and see what possible other dispositions there are for the others. Now, this was kind of a code word, I think, for continued detention. But a lot of people didn't notice it at the time. And so people thought that what the executive order said was try everybody or release them. But it didn't actually quite say that. And then what happened was this task force went and they looked at every single case. And they found that there were a large number of cases that they could not resolve, either by trial or by release. So they identified 48 detainees who they said, we can't try and we can't release. And then they identified another 58 or 60 detainees, all of them Yemenis, that they said, these are people who we could conceivably release either immediately or in the medium term, depending on conditions in Yemen. And the trouble is that conditions in Yemen got worse. So there's between those 48, one of whom's died now, and the 60-ish Yemenis, you have a fairly large group of people that the Obama administration does not believe it can release, at least until conditions improve in Yemen for some of them, and for some of them not at all. And then you have, in addition to that, 36 people whom they would like to bring to trial, of whom they've been able to bring to trial very few. So when you add all these groups of people together, there's a fairly large group of people whom they have not been able to transfer out of Guantanamo, and Congress is not letting them bring them to the United States for detention or trial here.
Well, in the United States, details are emerging about how the Obama administration may manage to shut down Guantanamo Bay by the president's January deadline.
One idea is to transfer them to the U.S. Army base at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas, which is also home to the Defense Department's only maximum security prison. But Leavenworth Mayor Shea Baker says residents don't want them.
If this relocation occurs, the entire Kansas City metropolitan area may face an increased risk of terrorism from sympathetic allies of the detainees. We are not worried about keeping prisoners in. We are worried about these sympathetic allies that would come to follow these detainees and potentially have terrorist attacks upon our citizens and our community.
You know, when some people said close Guantanamo, what they meant by that was we're going to end the detention outside of the criminal justice system. Barack Obama was always careful not to say that that's what he meant. He always reserved the possibility of continuing to detain certain people. But if you promise to close Guantanamo, you have to detain them somewhere. You have to have a location to do it. And they tried. They very much wanted to use a facility in Thompson, Illinois, that was empty and that they thought they could modify for use to hold that residual Guantanamo population that we just talked about. However, the Congress has been very resistant to the idea of holding people on U.S. soil and has forbidden the expenditure of money to bring people to the United States for detention. And this is, I think, one of the fundamental obstacles to closing Guantanamo is if you are insisting, as the administration is, that there's a group of people that you have to continue to detain, and Congress forbids you to detain them anywhere other than Guantanamo, it essentially guarantees that Guantanamo will remain open.
172 prisoners now remain at the base, 48 of whom the Obama administration has decided to keep holding indefinitely without trial. One of this last group died recently. Prevented by Congress from bringing any of these people onto U.S. soil, either for trial or detention, President Obama's options are limited.
For Guantanamo, the problem now is simply the indefinite detention, that is, detention of individuals without being charged with a crime, convicted, and assigned a sentence. And another issue, you know, is around a number of detainees, I think approximately 80, who've been cleared for release. Right? These are individuals the administration, through the task force, has said, we don't want to hold these people, yet they are, you know, yet they remain at Guantanamo because the U.S. can't find another country to send them to, and because the Obama administration can't politically now and legally bring them to the United States. So I think actually if there's going to be any real pressure point politically or with the courts at Guantanamo, it's going to involve the detainees who've been cleared for release or who've won their court cases and yet who are still sitting at Guantanamo. Because I think that is the area where the administration, in many respects, is most vulnerable. If not with the public, at least with the courts. We have this process now of habeas corpus review, but detainees who either win that process or who the government simply clears and says, you know, we can't hold them, there's no basis to hold them, that those detainees are still sitting at Guantanamo. I mean, I think it's scandalous, but I also think that that's an issue where there may be some real pressure from the courts. Then I think that will put some additional pressure on the political branches. But again, I don't think Guantanamo will ever return to claim the attention that it did during the Bush administration. It's clearly not a hot political issue at this point, and the attention that had been focused on Guantanamo is very different than it was 2-3 years ago. You know, hopefully there will be some political pressure, some international pressure, and some legal pressure enough to force change and for the prison to be closed and, you know, those who are going to be detained to receive fair trials. But unfortunately, the country seems to be kind of moving backward rather than forward in terms of grappling with Guantanamo, closing the prison, and restoring basic human rights.
Well, so it used to be that Guantanamo was an issue for the political left. The left didn't like George Bush. George Bush had Guantanamo. So the left demanded the closure of Guantanamo, and this was an issue that people on the right didn't talk about very much, and people on the left talked about a lot, including candidate Barack Obama. But now it has flipped almost completely. The left is still notionally committed to closing Guantanamo, but the Obama administration is not going to do it. And the people who spend a lot of time talking about Guantanamo now politically are conservatives, and they've found a commitment to Guantanamo that has been a very effective political weapon against the administration. It's a way of painting the administration as soft on terrorism and insufficiently committed to the country's security. And I think the administration is afraid of it as an issue, which is one of the reasons that they are so paralyzed in moving a policy based on closing Guantanamo forward.
Given the political and legal realities and the fact that even the president's own review identified prisoners who should be held indefinitely without trial, is there now an argument for keeping Guantanamo open?
Oh, absolutely. Just to be clear, I have never argued either for or against closing it. My view of the matter is that the question of where you engage in detention is much less important than the question of what the rules of that detention are going to be. And I've always argued that whether you do it at Guantanamo or you do it somewhere else is a sort of tail wagging the dog. The question should be, what is it that you're going to do? What rights do these people have? What sort of person are you and are you not going to detain? What does the government need to be able to prove? Once you answer all those questions, you effectuate that policy at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, or Thompson, Illinois, or Bagram Air Force Base, is a kind of a public relations issue that people feel really strongly about, but it's not actually the important set of questions. I certainly didn't oppose when the administration wanted to close Guantanamo. I wouldn't argue that closing Guantanamo is a bad idea, but I do think it's the wrong thing for us to be fixated on as a society, whether Guantanamo stays or goes. And I think we really should be having a much different conversation about the policy itself rather than the location of the policy.
And looking back over the years since it started taking detainees after 9/11, what is your view on the treatment of people who've gone there and also the legal machinations that have gone on around them?
There have clearly been detainees mistreated at Guantanamo. We found ourselves in the position of detaining huge numbers of people all of a sudden and having no idea what to do with them. And that took a number of years to sort of figure out what we were and weren't going to do. And I have just no doubt that detainees were mistreated, particularly the first couple of years of 2002 to 2003. Some very ugly stuff happened. The dirty little secret is that over the years, Guantanamo has turned into a model detention facility. It's a facility that's relatively open to public scrutiny now. You know, journalists go down there all the time. We know who the detainees are. Their cases get litigated openly in federal court. And so I actually think there's a lot to be said for the improvement that has happened at Guantanamo and for the facility that it's turned into over the years. But there's just no doubt that there was very unfortunate treatment of certain individuals there, both authorized and unauthorized. As to the legal machinations, look, the Bush administration tried something that was too clever by half. They tried to create a detention facility on a kind of an offshore banking model, right? That you could have something, it's like, you know, go to some little Caribbean island, I mean, literally to a Caribbean island, right? And establish a detention facility that we have total control over and the courts aren't going to supervise. And I think it was very unwise to think that you could get away with that in the long run. They paid an enormous price for it, internationally, domestically. And what we're left with is a serious and difficult problem, both of what to do with 173 people whose cases are sometimes very, very difficult, and the even harder question is what to do the next time the U.S. military captures a large number of people who are very hard to tell civilians from combatants, who may be really dangerous people, but who may not. It is interesting how little progress we've made on the core questions, what sort of review mechanisms those people should be subject to, what the substantive power to detain them looks like, how long it lasts, what rights they have. These are questions that we've really not successfully answered as a society.
Benjamin Witters from the Brookings Institution in Washington. We also heard Professor Jonathan Hafitz from Seton Hall Law School in New Jersey. And if you want to know more about the legal labyrinth in which Guantanamo detainees have wandered, do explore this week's special feature online at the ABC website. There's a link on the Rear Vision webpage for this program, abc.net.au/rn/rearvision, or just Google Rear Vision. The technical producer for Rear Vision today is Judy Rapley. I'm Keri Phillips.